It turns out Wall Street is just one big Ponzi scheme.
They were just kidding.
This is Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith, your pilgrim in postmodern collapse. We're going to talk crooks at the top and why the music will stop. We'll interview Michael Byron about living through it. Then I'll get to the details of how you can store food for the coming years now.
Bernie Madoff was known as the Wizard of Wall Street, but prosecutors say his brand of magic was like any other. It was all an illusion.
What a shocker. Another Wall Street icon turns out to be a cheap con man. Bernard Madoff stole from his friends, his clubmates, his fellow Jews, including the most wealthy and wise. Even the Rothschilds were taken. The story is too rich to leave alone because it illustrates the much larger landscape. The whole Americanized economy, wherever you find it, built on banking schemes and consumer debt, along with the stock markets and all the wizards, concealed the grandest larceny of history.
Do you presume to criticize the great Oz? You ungrateful creatures think yourselves lucky. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Who are you?
Oh, I am the great and powerful Wizard of Oz.
You are? I don't believe you.
No, I'm afraid it's true. There's no other wizard except me.
You humbug!
Yeah.
Yes, it's exactly so. I'm a humbug.
Oh, you're a very bad man.
Poor Bernie Madoff. He was the former chairman of the NASDAQ stock market. He knew all the top people, and they trusted him completely. Madoff, the honored icon of business, who started his own investment firm in 1960. Here is Bernie Madoff describing in October 2007 how stiff regulation makes fraud impossible.
In today's regulatory environment, it's virtually impossible to violate rules. And this is something that the public really doesn't understand. And if you read things in the newspaper and you see somebody, you know, violate a rule, you say, well, you know, they're always doing this. But it's impossible for you to go for a violation to go undetected. Certainly not for a considerable period of time. And when you consider the volumes of trading, the trillions of dollars of trading that go on, our firm, for example, alone, we trade in excess of $1 trillion a year. So, and that's one firm. You know, so when you look at the scope of the trading that goes on today in Wall Street, and you look at what we would consider to be the infractions, they're relatively small, you know, primarily because, you know, of all the regulation. And most firms do try to comply with that.
Well, it turns out all the people who should have been investigating, say in the FBI, were hauled off to become terrorism experts, but that's another story. Huge endowment funds, the mainstay of universities, charitable foundations, and funds of funds put billions into Madoff's hands. They got a statement of trades, which is now alleged to be fraudulent, and they got about 10% interest every year, no matter what happened in the stock market. The operation had a tiny accounting firm somewhere in New England. Why ask questions? The returns were so good and stable, while others struggled with the ups and downs of markets. Madoff had investment magic. His specialty was getting money from the well-heeled Jews of New York City and Palm Beach, Florida. Down in Florida, a lot of wealthy people suddenly found themselves cleaned out recently. In New York, several Jewish charities, including one that investigated wrongly jailed people, will close right away. Except for a few $100 million, all the billions are gone. Two big hedge funds, Fairfield Century and Kinggate Global, had almost $10 billion with Madoff. They might get $10 million back. The owner of the New York Mets baseball team had big accounts managed by Madoff. Swiss banks and the Spanish bank Santander will likely lose several $1 billion. Ditto the Royal Bank of Scotland and HSBC Bank in England. This man was everywhere, claiming huge trades and massive influence in the financial system. In the video, someone claims Madoff's company trades amounted to 10% of the New York Stock Exchange business. In fact, it now appears most of the trading was fictitious. Nobody really noticed Madoff's billions moving around. Bernie always had an explanation.
The stunning collapse could cost the global total of £33 billion and impact heavily on pension funds.
people will start to shy away from saving their money in pension schemes and investment schemes if they think the system's not robust enough to look after them.
Bernard Madoff was arrested and charged with one count of fraud. He faces up to 20 years in prison and a $5 million fine. He is 70 years old. The final kicker? Even those who realized they were being scammed and pulled out their money in the last year or two may be forced to return that money for redistribution to other victims. After all, in the Ponzi scheme, Madoff used the money from new investments to pay out the interest or the full refunds if people asked for them. When he ran out of suckers and withdrawals rose for those needing more money in these tough times, Bernie Madoff allegedly confessed to his sons that it was all a pyramid racket.
The case is likely to fuel uncertainty over the entire hedge fund industry. Some analysts believe that as the credit crunch bites deeper, more wrongdoing will be exposed.
When I heard about the illustrious crook of Wall Street buried deep in the hive, I'm sorry, but I had to laugh. All those people upset about their disappearing money in America or in Europe or anywhere in Asia will be captivated by this rogue captain of investment. But don't let the media focus in just on that. Think about it. Madoff isn't the exception. Since the day of Ronnie Reagan's deregulation, pyramid schemes have taken over Wall Street and pretty well every Western bank and insurance company in the world, and now those experts run our governments. The whole American housing mortgage system becomes a vehicle for fraud. Mortgage lending and bank employees, well, they encourage false income statements and other malfeasance so that anyone could get a loan. They just have to pay the interest. No down payment. Don't worry about any of that. After all, the fees were paid out in front. This was repackaged into derivatives and sold to other banks, institutions, and investors all over the world and sold as good as gold. The rating companies like Fitch and Standard & Poor's were paid by the same issuing banks and investment houses. They played along, giving AAA ratings to piles of toxic sludge. And to my knowledge, these phony ratings have not been investigated, and no one has been charged with this gigantic global fraud, the largest of all time. Then, just to make more crime money, the same institutions at the top bet crazy amounts, at least $50 trillion worth, on who would pay and who would default. You can call that credit default swaps or CDOs, it's all wrapped up in there, and they bet more money than the world is worth, and they want all the taxpayers to keep shoveling money into that big black hole.
So this has created a multi-hundred trillion dollar black hole of debt, and no matter how many trillions of dollars they try to bail themselves out of this black hole of debt, even if they liquidated the entire U.S. economy, it's still not going to be enough to fill in this black hole of naked short selling and counterfeiting debt that the investment banks on Wall Street.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You know, our economy seems to be crashing right along with many natural systems, not to mention the climate. What the heck can any of us do about it? We have Michael Byron here with us today. He's a professor of political science in the San Diego area with two books. The first one's Infinity's Rainbow, The Politics of Energy, Climate, and Globalization. And then more recently, The Path Through Infinity's Rainbow, Your Guide for Personal Survival and Spiritual Transformation in a World Gone Mad. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Alex.
Well, Mike, in your first Infinity's Rainbow book, you outlined the developing crisis in energy and the climate. And on this radio show, I've been hammering away on the same topic. So I'm going to assume that our listeners already know a fair amount about that. But they may not know your theory that, if I understand it rightly, that these breaking points come from a kind of weakness in human design. Could you explain how our own drives have delivered us to the edge of this breakdown?
Well, Alex, to a significant degree, the broad composition of human civilization reflects our desires and our motivations, and we have always wanted more. Not necessarily everybody, not necessarily every listener, but speaking broadly for humanity as a whole, we've wanted more. And in our attempts to get more, to get as much as possible, as quickly as possible, and damn the consequences, we have set forces in motion which are poised to overwhelm our natural environment, the carrying capacity of the Earth, and which haven't really satisfied our deep fundamental desires. We find that, it's more and more. You think if we could just buy more stuff, if we just get that magic last bit of the right kind of stuff, then all of a sudden we'd be happy. And yet it doesn't happen. It doesn't work that way. That's the point where we really need to fundamentally reevaluate ourselves. You talk about reevaluating civilization, our nation states, and so forth, but more fundamental to that is reevaluating ourselves, is discovering ourselves, is changing ourselves. If we do that, civilization will change. If we don't do that, then we're not addressing the fundamental problem, and those problems will just continue to get worse.
And you have studied past civilizations in the kind of macro pattern idea. I wonder if those earlier people, when they were faced with big challenges, whether it was in Rome or some other civilization in trouble, did they go through these periods of personal reevaluation?
Well, sometimes and sometimes not. It's difficult to generalize too much, but by and large, when faced with really fundamental existential crisis, where I mean crisis of existence, by and large, they tended not to.
And
they tended to fall, often catastrophically. But now we have a situation where in the past, civilizations have been local, they've been regional, and when they have fallen, then it has only affected one particular part of the world. The fall of Western Roman Empire, for example, had no effect on civilization in India or in China or in Mesoamerica or Peru. Now we have a global civilization, and if global civilization is to fall anywhere, it's going to fall everywhere. It's an all-or-nothing proposition because it's so tightly interconnected. We've also never faced a situation where we have completely overwhelmed the ability of the biosphere itself to provide for us, and we're doing that now. So we're in very fundamentally unique territory, and we either learn or we collapse, basically. It's as simple as that. The time is very short. I'd like to say I'm optimistic, and I hope that I'm optimistic. Certainly we have efforts like yours and many, many other people and organizations around the world. But yet, as you can see, the world is still pretty much on the same trajectory that it's been on in recent times.
Well, everything seems so normal. I can still go to the mall and find the shelves loaded with pretty cheap stuff. I wonder, how close to the edge of some cliff do you think we really are?
Well, with respect to energy, supplies of conventional crude oil have been essentially flat since 2005, without respect to prices. What that indicates is that we're at about the maximum of our ability to extract oil from the ground, about 85 billion barrels a day. Is approximately the upper limit. Any additional oil above and beyond that is a lot harder to get, has less net energy content. So we're not going to come up with additional sources of energy to power our civilization into some as yet undetermined future. And even if we could, we're already overwhelming the ability of the Earth's biosphere to cope with our effects on it, the effects of our civilization on it, of our producing and using energy within that biosphere. And so basically the climate is shifting, long-term weather is shifting as a result. Agriculture, everybody's got to eat. Agriculture is a bet that we understand the long-term weather patterns with regard to temperature and rainfall and so forth well enough to predictably grow crops there. As we change, force rapid changes in the biosphere, we're forcing rapid changes in rainfall patterns, in average temperature, and the net effect is increasingly we lose the bet as to our understanding of climate well enough to be able to grow crops predictably, we don't feed our people. Population is increasing rapidly. Herbert Stein, who is the father of the comedian Ben Stein, was Nixon's budget director, the American president, back in the 1970s, 60s and 70s, and he famously used to always say, things that don't go on forever can't. Well, we have a whole series of trends right now which are amplifying and which cannot go on for very much longer without it becoming impossible for us to organize ourselves as we have been doing. Something's got to change, and it's not going to be nature that becomes more accommodating to us in some way. What's got to change is us, or alternately, we will find that we've blown it, and that our civilization collapses in smoking ruins. We take out a good bit of the life in the biosphere with us, and the whole 10,000-year effort of civilization will have proven to have been fruitless, literally.
Well, these are scary things. We're talking with Michael Byron. He's the author and professor of political science, and I'm trying to picture, Mike, the mental state of all the citizens who are losing their homes or fear losing their jobs and savings. We even have to worry about food now. There has to be a wave of fear and anger and despair out there. How is our emotional reaction? Is that part of the problem now in rebuilding a sustainable society?
Well, it may be part of the solution because of, you know, the saying, happy people don't make history. If the civilization that we have so patiently put together for the past decades and centuries and millennia were continuing to deliver in the way we would expect it to deliver, people would be relatively content. And yet now increasingly people are fearful. The American state I live in, California, has got huge and rising budget deficits. And this, of course, is playing havoc with everything. I work for the state in teaching. My wife works for the state as being a social worker. Our coworkers, our friends, people everywhere are very, very afraid, very, very nervous, very uncertain. And there's a sense that somehow something isn't right. Something has fundamentally gone wrong. And while this is a scary time, it's also an exciting and an exhilarating time. It's a time of opportunity because it is a time when people are most receptive to the ideas of fundamental change. And so we have an opportunity here. We have possibly the last opportunity that we're going to have. One of the points that I've made in both of the books is that the hydrocarbon energy that we built civilization on is something which was accumulated across tens and hundreds of millions of years. As far as we're concerned, it's a non-renewable resource. Possibly 150 million years in the future, there might be some more. That's way beyond human timescale. Quite a bit of evidence suggests that because the sun is brightening as it ages, it's brightened about 20% since the Earth formed, the CO2 levels in the atmosphere have been going down for geological ages. Within another half a billion years at most, complex life on Earth will be impossible because there won't be any CO2 in the atmosphere. This basically means that humanity, whether we're the best of all possible life forms that might have existed in the geological history of Earth or not, that are tapping these carbon energy resources right now, building a civilization which is potentially capable of expanding life beyond the Earth itself for this brief period in time, that this is the one and only shot that complex life on this Earth is ever going to get at transcending the barriers of Earth, of spreading life from Earth into the solar system, of allowing for an open-ended future for life in the universe. If we blow it, and so far you'd have to say that we're moving in that direction, then it doesn't matter if we go extinct as a result of our folly. 50 million years from now, something descended from, say, squirrels develops a brain in a better ethical sense than humans had. We will have burned up their energy supply, the energy supply that was available for some life form on the Earth forever. They're basically stuck here on the ground with low energy because of our folly. So this is our one, it's our only shot to achieve a viable civilization. And it's interesting because North America has been so much at the forefront of the development of technological civilization, and yet our values, what's been missing from our values are the sort of values that the people that preceded us on this continent, the North American Indians, had. If you have a combination of sort of the technological optimism of North Americans with the social and spiritual wisdom of the original North Americans, if somehow that could have been combined together, we would certainly be a heck of a lot better off, because what we need to discover are the alternative values to the deep materialistic, I want mine, and I don't care, you know, what happens to the earth as long as I get mine. What we have to discover, what we have to reinvent, they've been discovered before, but we have to reinvent those kind of values. We need those values at the core of our civilization. If they're not there, then just tinkering with clean coal, tinkering with technology is it leads us to disaster.
We've certainly seen that on Wall Street, where, you know, one of the most trusted advisors made off with $50 billion of people's money. So, yeah, certainly, and the whole subprime housing thing seemed like a Ponzi scheme on its own. But I don't want to get off on that right now, because I want to concentrate. In your book, you've talked about personal survival and spiritual transformation. Can you give our listeners a couple of tips on what we can do personally to handle this horrible situation?
Well, you want to be as self-sufficient as far as for providing for yourself as is possible with respect to energy, with respect to water, with respect to food. We have a section on terra preta soils, putting carbon into the soil to make it much more fertile and need little to no fertilizer. And beyond that, beyond becoming as self-sufficient as possible, we need to network with other people in our local communities who feel similarly. We need to try to capture control of political systems from the bottom up, from local city councils, town councils, local government, and work our way up. National government is something that is remote. It's difficult to really effectively control as citizens, but we can control our local governments, and using that as a platform, we can exert influence upwards into higher levels of government. So I make a big point on you know, rather than trying to get particular people elected as leaders of countries, it's important to get control of your local government and then go on from there to state or provincial legislatures, governors, invert the process. Mm-hmm. And in addition to forming local networks of people and controlling local government, then to network out, a network of networks, interconnected network, to people in other communities, other states and provinces, other continents, so that what you have is a holistically integrated network of networks. Not everybody is doing the same exact thing. Everybody has the same basic concerns, though, and is pushing in the same direction and influencing everybody else. So where do people, will say to me, well, where do I start? And I say, well, start with yourself. Start with how you live your life, how you organize your life. And then you're talking to me. That's a network. So, you know, let's keep that up. Talk to other people who feel similarly. Form networks, build networks. Everybody has to be at the center of the process. And nobody can really be a passive free rider. We all have to be, it's an overworn phrase, but agents of change.
Well, as we wrap up, Michael, is there anything else you'd like to quickly leave with our listeners?
Well, I do explain all of this in a lot more detail in my two books, Infinity's Rainbow and The Path Through Infinity's Rainbow. Certainly, so anybody that wants to pursue any of the ideas that I've touched on in greater detail can do so through the books. But basically, what my message is stop waiting for somebody to do something. You become that somebody. You get out there, and even if you're not quite sure exactly what to do, do something rather than nothing, and do it now.
Well, I think that's what we're both up to, and I certainly agree with you. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, talking with Michael Byron, spelled B-Y-R-O-N. Find our guest's website at michaelpbyron.com. Thank you so much, Michael.
Okay, thank you, Alex.
Is your mutual fund down or your pension ravaged a little bit? Here's, a couple of tips from one of the experienced people on Wall Street who's left the country. It's Max Keiser, spelled K-E-I-S-E-R. Find him at maxkeiser.com, explaining why it hits you.
So this type of thing goes on all the time. So mutual funds on the big industrial wholesale money management business are where typically losses are dumped, and particularly in pension funds. Pension funds are where losses go to die. You know, because they have very bad management and they have very low threshold of expectation in terms of what their returns are. So many, many times I've seen where brokerages have made mistakes and they've got these huge losses. They dump them in pension accounts. And the pension account at the end of the year, instead of being up 20% like the market, was only up 1% or down 2 or 3%. And everyone just blames, oh, you know, it was a bad year. But for the most part, it's just fraud. You know, the level of fraud is so unbelievably deep-rooted in the brokerage industry, has been for decades, especially since Reagan deregulated.
My thanks to my listener friend in Colorado, you know who you are, for that one. And bringing Max Keiser to my attention once again, we should never miss out on him. Now, coming up, we're going to have a whole thing about why food may freeze up, and no, not that wild headline that was in the Daily Kos the other day about famine 2009, but serious things happening in the whole realm of food, and some tips about what you can do to save your own food in case you might need it in the year 2010 or 2011 when the rubber hits the road. Stick with Radio EcoShock. Our second half hour is coming up. In the meantime, here's a bit of Miller and Boverman with their song Clear Cut.
I was driving down some big highway, somewhere going someplace, through a town that looked just like the last. I passed a billboard that said, if I buy that shit I'd feel better. I just pulled off to fill up the gas. In the truck stop TV showed the president's face, with the stars and stripes waving in back. He said, my fellow Americans, I can assure you today, peace and freedom is why we attacked. And it's days like these I find myself growing cold, trying to hold the rage that I feel. In this country of hearts that are freezing like ice, in this nation asleep at the wheel, I feel like I'm clear cut. I feel like my rivers have run dry, and I'm raw beneath the open sky and the rain. When it comes, will carry me away in a landslide. Everywhere I go, I see people who know something is terribly wrong. They say there's nothing anyone can do about it now. It's been going on for way too long. And all we can do is just learn how to cope, try to make it through another year. Yeah, who needs dictatorship or martial law when you got TV, dependence, and fear?
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Meanwhile, the kings and queens in their castles are trying to turn everything they touch into gold. And even the devastation they leave in their wake is a new market to be bought and then sold.
In other news, an asteroid is coming from outer space to destroy your bank and your savings. That's right, NASA has picked up a specialized rock heading for Earth next year. When it hits the Earth's atmosphere, the asteroid, known as CDO-CDS, will shatter the financial system. I've been meaning to tell you this ever since I read an article in the Australian Business Spectator on November 19, 2008, but hey, I got busy, you know how it goes. From his spot on the underside of the planet, Alan Kohler writes about a tsunami of hope or terror. He thinks the collateralized debt obligation, the friendly CDO, could wind up saving the global banking system, or wrecking it, and that's the best hope we've got? Alan is talking about a Wall Street gimmick called the synthetic collateralized debt obligation. It's not even a real CDO. It's synthetic, like a cheap plastic, because it is based on credit default swaps, a kind of debt insurance, rather than any wealth that actually exists on the planet. The idea was dreamed up by none other than Michael Milliken, the convicted fraudster, just before he went to jail in the late 1980s. The synthetic CDO is a bet on whether somebody, or more likely some company, will default on its debt. I may not have any interest in General Motors, no shares or bonds or anything like that, but I'll bet they don't go under. And if you are a bank worried about such things, you can pay me a tiny bit of interest, actually a bit better than I would normally get. And I promise, if GM goes bankrupt, which as we all know is impossible, then I'll have to pay off the debt the car company owed you. It's really a casino for debt. Somebody in Hong Kong can bet for or against any company just for the hell of it. These synthetic CDOs were sold by banks and big investment companies into the trillions of dollars. What you don't know, as the purchaser, the banks set up a special company in some tax haven with lax laws like the Cayman Islands. They might get a local charity to sit on the board. That is really who I bought from, even though the bank called me and we did the deal in a bank office. Our bet is very complex. It might say that I have to pay up some really large sum if only 10 out of 100 big American firms go bankrupt. These companies in the list would be giants like GM, American Insurance Corporation, and Dow Chemical, Fannie Mae, and some big-name home builders. Well, as you can see, there's really no risk, we're told. So municipalities, charities, college endowment funds, and all kinds of normally cautious pension funds and just plain old people bought up lots and lots of synthetic CDOs to get that extra kick of interest payments, and the bankers made the money selling them as well. These suckers didn't really know what they were getting into. They thought they were dealing with a reputable bank. The switcheroo to a numbered company offshore was hidden in the hundreds of pages of legal language documents. They were told such companies could never go broke. The investment was as good as gold. As you know, boys and girls, many of the big companies on these lists, like Bear Stearns and Lehman, have already gone bankrupt and others are teetering on the edge. It looks more and more likely that the magic figure of 10 or so, well, they'll be gone by 2009. And when that level is reached, all you hear is a huge sucking sound all over the world. That's because these unlucky suckers already deposited their millions of savings into the synthetic CDO accounts. Now, when the great day of reckoning comes, hundreds of billions of dollars, more likely trillions, will be removed from these institutions, hoovered out of there from the pension funds and the investors all over the world. And the money will travel offshore to these companies that cannot be sued. Likely it will end up back in the big banks that, well, brought it all out in the first place. But these banks can deny that and hide behind thick legal documents, no matter how much people are wailing about their lost money. When the synthetic credit default obligations come home to roost, some big banks may be flooded with money. At the same time, states, municipalities, pensions, charities, insurance companies, and other investors will be wiped out. There is a written contractual date in all these trillion-dollar bets. With enough big companies going bankrupt, when the tipping point comes, the financial system and our social system will be washed away by a tsunami. So don't say I didn't tell you.
They're banking on the trouble, banking on a need, cause they got a double dose of serious greed. We see what they're doing and we understand. Economic justice is what we demand. The time has come for some confrontation to stop them from banking on our desperation. They're predators, predators. They keep devouring more and more. They're predators, predators. They're getting richer by preying on the poor. Getting richer by preying on the poor. Getting richer by preying on the poor.
How big is this credit default swap? Chris Whalen of Institutional Risk Analytics explained it in a recent meeting of the New York chapter of Risk Management Association. Mr. Whalen's figures, quote, 1. Start with the $50 trillion or so in extant CDS, that's credit default swaps. 2. Assume that as the default rates for all types of collateral rise over the next 24 to 36 months, 40% of the $50 trillion in CDS goes into that money. That's a $20 trillion gross notional of CDS which must be funded. 3. Now assume a 25% recovery rate against that portion of all the CDS that goes into that money. 4. That leaves you with a $15 trillion net amount that must be paid by providers of protection in CDS. And remember, a 40% in the money assumption for CDS is very conservative. The rise in loss rates for all type of collateral over the next 24 months could easily make the portion of CDS in the money grow to more like 60 or 70%. That is 40 plus trillion dollars in notional payments versus a recovery rate in single digits. Does anybody really believe the global central banks and the politicians that stand behind them are going to provide the liquidity to fund $15 trillion or more in CDS payouts? Remember, only a small portion of these positions are actually hedging exposure. The rest are speculative, in some cases 10, 20, 30 times the underlying basis. Yet the position taken by the Treasury Secretary Paulson and implemented by Tim Geithner and the Fed Board in Washington, to be fair, is that these leveraged wagers should be paid in full. Our answer to this cowardly view is that AIG needs to be put into bankruptcy. Whalen goes on to say, quote, the danger of CDS is not a systematic blow-up, though that will come soon enough. It is the normal operation of now electronically enabled CDS market wherein lies the threat to the entire global financial system. This via a huge drain in liquidity, illustrated above as CDS contracts are triggered by default events. The only way to deal with this ridiculous Ponzi scheme is bankruptcy. Find the article, What Barack Obama Needs to Know About Tim Geithner, The AIG Fiasco and Citigroup, by Chris Whalen, November 24, 2008, at us1.institutionalriskanalytics.com.
How much more money do you think the Federal Reserve has? They've trotted out hundreds of billions of dollars so far to bail out their friends on Wall Street. How much more money do you think they've got?
As you know, General Motors is a swirling home in this hole. According to Bloomberg News last August, quote, a default by one of the automakers would trigger write-downs and losses in the $1.2 trillion market for collateralized debt obligations that pool derivatives linked to corporate debt. Credit default swaps on GM and Ford were included in more than 80% of CDOs created before they lost their investment-grade debt rankings in 2005, according to data compiled by Standard & Poor's. So Obama and company, with his new Treasury head Tim Geithner, are playing the same stall game. Like Bush, they will toss trillions and more of future tax money all borrowed from foreigners, they hope, into this endless black hole, all conjured up by the gamblers of Wall Street. The money goes into a black hole, and it never comes out again. That's called deflation. Well, you too can be a deflation fighter. Your mutual funds have already contributed about $1 trillion to the black hole campaign. Stocks are helping too. More giant losses nobody will ever see again. Go on, don't be shy. Kick in the last of those savings too if you have any. A computer will be around to collect them soon as more vanishing money. Feed the black hole. If your brain is melting, here is Max Keiser putting it a little less politely.
But what we're seeing now is this downward deflationary spiral, because no matter how many trillions of dollars they print or borrow to throw at the problem, it goes into this black hole of corrupt Wall Street banks, corrupt Federal Reserve banks. And it's a black hole worth hundreds of trillions of dollars. It's a huge black hole of debt that even if every single stock, bond, and house in America were liquidated and sold to the Chinese and that money was thrown into this black hole of debt, it still would not create equilibrium in the U.S. economy. You would still have downward pressure. The only solution, and has been alluded to here, is America's going to have to sell off huge pieces of itself to its creditors, including China, the Mideast, South Korea.
You can listen to more from Mad Max, who is actually an expatriate Wall Street trader, at maxkaiser.com, spelled K-E-I-S-E-R. Come on, citizen, do your duty. Give up your money and your children's money. Feed the black hole. Feed the hole. Feed the hole.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo, Sally Mae. To MasterCard and Citibank.
Food, food. The United Nations is warning of riots in many countries this year as the farm system breaks down. For one thing, the credit system has broken down. But somebody, using the name Stranded Wind, went too far in the Daily Kos blog for November 27, 2008, I think. The headline reads, "The Famine of 2009." But this windy citizen is talking about hunger in America. For one thing, the western farmers of the Dakotas can't get enough propane to dry out their crops properly. That means poor storage. And apparently the nation's biggest private crop insurance program is in trouble, in part due to last summer's hurricane and storm damage. Stranded Wind writes, "Payments that would have come in June or July of a normal year are still not dispersed at the end of November, and this has grim implications for next year's crop. Since credit has dropped out of sight, the farmers aren't putting on the usual amount of fertilizer, only 10% of the normal application. There is also a shortage of ammonia, the source of nitrogen fertilizer." My conversations with farmers earlier this week lead me to believe that the largest private insurer, Des Moines, Iowa, Rain and Hail Agricultural Insurance, may be insolvent. Flooding claims from this spring, can you say climate change, were filed, and payments that would have typically been received by the end of June or the beginning of July, it's now the end of November, and payments are not being dispersed. Individual farmers are being told there was something wrong with their paperwork, but this is nonsense. Some of these guys have been farming 30 years, and they didn't all forget how to fill out a simple form all at the same time. Iowa did have its second 500-year flood in a decade, and half this spring, which certainly has something to do with the situation. But I suspect Wall Street's sticky fingers got hold of Rain and Hail's assets, just as they've done to every pension fund and state-run municipal investment pool. So we're already facing what Brian Luter calls the mother of all fertilizer shortages next spring, and on top of that, the local banks won't lend to farmers. The local bank was quite willing to lend to a farmer on a crop despite the weather-related risks, just like they'd lend on a car despite the driving risks. So long as the asset was insured, the risk was deemed manageable. There were sure to be losses here and there, but they'd be administrative hassles associated with well-known risks. If the auto insurance companies were viewed as untrustworthy, no one would be getting a car without 100% down at the dealership, and the same rule is now in effect for farmers. Farmers without financing can't afford nitrogen fertilizer at $1,000 a ton. The average farm size in Iowa is 400 acres, and planting to harvesting would run about $120,000. This looks incredibly bad. Brian and I are both puzzled as to why the mainstream media isn't covering this. Perhaps the need to sell Christmas season advertising trumps the need for the public to know about the troubles that are brewing. That's from Stranded Wind, posting on the Daily Kos, November 27th. As author Gwynne Dyer said on Radio EcoShock last week, there is little chance that Americans will starve in 2009 any more than the poorest usually do. By 2010 or 2011, the complete collapse of the financial system may break some of the fragile links of our own food chain. You know, the stuff coming to the supermarket. A continent so rich in food as we are may have trouble delivering it to all the big cities. I could see food interruptions coming, maybe not lasting famine, but times when you just can't get some of the basics, perhaps for a month or three. That's just one reason why I'm storing food. After all, you may have health insurance for now, but why not invest a couple of $100 in food insurance for you and your family? Later in this program, I'll tell you how my own food storage project is going.
Global food prices continue to soar, causing hunger and rioting in many parts of the world. But according to a recent report by international NGO Grain, there is another side to the story. The report, Making a Killing from Hunger, says big profits are being made by several food corporations and investors. Devlin Kuyek, a lead author of the report, finds that the problem is more than a food shortage or a price blip. He says the food system is experiencing a structural meltdown.
You heard a quick clip there from The Real News at TheRealNews.com.
Now, the Victory Garden has to come back, guys. If people understood exactly what's going on with food, we would not have one green lawn in this country. It would all be rototilled up, and people would be planting anything they can get for fall vegetables. Those that don't have the ability to plant would be putting in 3 to 4 years of food.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I can't tell you what to do, but I can tell you what I'm doing. And this is my running audio blog of food storage, Alex Tries Storing Food at Home. It turns out that some of the best teachers in this quest to store food are people from the Church of the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. This branch of Christianity was chased out of several Midwest states before landing as settlers in Utah. They experienced a crop failure due to locusts and could never count on outside help due to persecution from the federal government. So the early church demanded its members store at least 1 year's worth of food at all times. These days, the church only requires 3 months' worth of food stored, but suggests 1 year and even several years of supplies if possible. As a result, Mormons get together as a community to save food, and they keep passing on the techniques of canning and general food preservation. They are still a great source for you online. For example, go to YouTube.com and search Mormon Women Food. Mormon is spelled M-O-R-M-O-N. You'll get a series of homemade videos showing several basements with handy food storage hints. One basement also had several backpacks loaded up with emergency supplies. I found that interesting. It was explained as gifts for students who might travel through in an emergency. Maybe such supplies for moving on might help get transients on their way if things get tough. Or these backpacks could be the phenomenon described on the net as bug-out bags. Go ahead and search for that. Bugging out is when you decide your current location is untenable and you have to go, possibly on foot, in a hurry. Perhaps some of the residents burned out near Los Angeles in the fires, or the residents of Galveston and other hurricane zones wished they had such packs. A bug-out pack might contain some dry clothes, a raincoat, some plastic to make a shelter, food, including energy bars, whatever medicine you routinely take, a couple of water bottles, and whatever else you think is necessary, like maybe a flashlight. In my opinion, every family should have a bug-out pack for each member. You never know when a chemical plant, a terrorist strike, a fire, or ferocious storm might force you out, like the millions of hurricane refugees this year alone. I'm trying to learn about canning food in bottles. Again, if you search for Mormon and canning, you'll get The Mormon Chef, with some excellent video showing just how to do it safely using a pressure cooker. But you will also need a canning book showing how to deal with all kinds of foods because the internet may go down or electricity may not be available when you need the info. Also, I recommend trying it out now as it takes time to learn the routines and techniques of food storage. ¶¶
I got my food storage, but no place to put it. I got my 2 year storage, but no place to put it. It's under my bed, behind the door, stacked in a pile, in the middle of the floor, with a tablecloth on it.
Personal food storage is harder if you have to begin out of season. Of course, fruit and vegetables are going to be cheaper and available in bulk right at harvest season in the fall. That's also when the canning bottles and equipment show up on store shelves. Just a month later, all that stock disappears. Apparently, it's shipped back to some distant warehouse, creating more greenhouse gases. Let's say you need to start in December or some other inconvenient time. It's going to be hard, but not impossible, to find a canning kettle and jars in your city or locale. I found mine in the basement of a local old-style hardware store. These are items you don't want to pay shipping on. Phone around and keep scouring until you find the bottles and related equipment. Really, I wouldn't wait until next fall. Who knows how weird or desperate the food situation will be by then. Maybe in the crashing economy, either the retailer or the shipper will be out of business. Maybe the ships with cheap supplies coming from China will not come. Or consider this, the electricity could go out for a month or more, as happened in Quebec after a major ice storm and in Galveston, Texas after Hurricane Ike. What happens to all the food in your freezer? You have to toss it out, unless you are able to can it. These days, people say, so what? We'll just buy more food. But if you lose your job, or the food supplies get damaged by the economy or climate disruption, refilling the freezer may not be so easy. Even if you are not ready to start canning today, get a few dozen wide-mouth mason jars and extra lids now. You will need 7-quart or 7-liter canning kettle with a wire rack. Mine cost $23, even when bought out of season with no sale on. Other requirements, a pair of jar grips to get out the scalding hot bottles and a wide-mouth funnel to load them up. Another $20, if that. I also intend to get a pressure canner as the money becomes available. The canning kettle is just a big pot, usually black. The pressure canner is generally stainless steel with a pressure gauge and a tight-fitting lid. They cost anywhere from $100 to $400. Your cheap canning kettle will do almost all acidic fruits and sauces made from them. But really safe canning of vegetables, beans, and meat requires a higher heat than a regular old canning kettle delivers. Both use the same bottles. You can find out more about pressure canning online. With that equipment, you can store almost anything wet. There is even a video on YouTube where a woman bakes bread in jars using a solar cooker outside and then puts on the lids to make canned bread. You will also find videos about how to can butter. Canning is a worthwhile skill and a future necessity if the Depression comes. Not only will you be able to buy farm products when they're cheapest, to eat all year, saving lots of money, you will also be able to store ready-made meals such as chili and so on without depending upon refrigeration or electricity. Your dried food can be stored for much longer periods of time using common buckets with a tight lid. You want to acquire a dozen or more food-grade plastic buckets. I got some of mine for free with the tight-fitting lids from a local bakery. The bakeries often throw such buckets out. I also purchased some new buckets from a paint store. No paint was ever in them. These are brand new buckets with the rubber sealer around the underside of the lid. I wouldn't use the paint buckets for actual food storage unless I first put the food inside Mylar bags, which I'll be talking about shortly. If you pour rice or wheat berries into these buckets and seal them up, the food should keep from 3 to 5 years. Wheat berries is just the wheat before it's ground. Sorry, but white rice stores better than brown rice. Okay, you'll need a hand grinder or a mill to turn your wheat into flour as well. Wheat keeps for an amazing period in dry conditions. There are rumors that edible wheat was recovered from an Egyptian tomb. I can't vouch for that. But you can store wheat for 10 to 20 years in plastic buckets if you remove the oxygen from the bucket before tightening the lid. Oxygen is required by most organisms that destroy dry food. You can remove it with dry ice, as shown on YouTube, but that is harder to judge than buying oxygen depletion packets online from a survival-type site, as I did. As custom rates can be high, try to purchase such products in your own country. This has become sort of a running blog of my home trials of food storage, and for my listener in Sweden who wrote in asking for specific details, here's how it's going. I'll be storing wheat, dried peas, and pinto beans, all purchased in 25-pound bags from a cooperative in Vancouver. Finding larger amounts of anything is harder these days. When people ate at home and cooked, we could always find these big bags of supplies, but now even the superstores have 2-pound or 2-kilogram peas at the most. The whole system is designed to keep you coming back, buying small quantities. Even our food supply is just-in-time delivery. You may have to ask around to find a friendly restaurant or commercial food supplier to get your stock in bulk. Consider it an adventure in food. Here are a few specifics about prices. These are based in Canadian dollars. In December 2008, I bought my buckets for $9.95 at a wine place, so I know that they're food grade. It was a winemaking place right here in town. You can find one in your town. And then, of course, those come with the lids for that price. I bought 10 kilograms of dried whole peas for $24 at a local co-op, and that filled up three smaller bags, which went into a bucket, pretty well took up the bucket full, so I've got a bucket of dried whole peas, and 10 kilograms of dried pinto beans. Again, that was enough to fill up three smaller Mylar bags into a bucket. We had no problem sealing the Mylar. We'd filled up the bag and left a few inches at the top. We actually put a piece of cloth on the edge of a table, then put the Mylar edges in there, put another piece of an old t-shirt on top, set the iron to a fairly hot setting, usually cotton. You have to hold it down and press for a minute or two, then it really seals up. If you've missed a spot, you can easily see that and just put it down and iron it again until you've got it all tight. Of course, I threw in oxygen depleters, one package for each of those smaller bags, and then one on the top to suck in the air that was left in the bucket, and sealed it up good and tight with a board and a hammer. When it came to the wheat, I ordered 10 kilograms of certified organic red wheat. It came to $33.70. That's about $3.30 per kilogram. That's pretty pricey, too pricey for me, because I want to get a lot of it. So what I've done is I've ordered 325 kilogram bags from a feed store. It turns out that red wheat is also used to feed animals, and there's very little difference between the red wheat used by a bakery, for example, and that used to feed animals. It's just the animals might have a little more chaff, and it might need a little bit of cleaning before you use it. But it's way, way cheaper, $22 for a 25-kilogram bag of that. So I think that's the route I'm going to go. But it turns out I'm having to wait 2 weeks to get it, even though I'm in a town that has huge grain storage areas, and we service much of the world here from Vancouver, but it's very hard to find bulk red wheat to put away to store. But once you get it and put it away in the Mylar bag, seal it up with the oxygen depleters, put it in the buckets, should last 10 to 15 years, maybe longer than that. I've seen somebody on YouTube open up a bucket and the wheat was perfectly fine 16 years later. You can check that out on the web. We don't have time today to cover dried fruits and the whole range of other food storage techniques such as root cellars and winter forcing of vegetables. Another time for that. I'm Alex Smith. I'll let you know how my little city food storage project develops as I go along. If you have tips, send an email to radio@ecoshock.org.
I got tons of wheat, but no wheat grinder. And I packed myself in a steak cannery, and it's in my closet, my garage, in my attic, in my crawl space. But no wheat grinder. I got barrels of beans, but I don't really like them. All kinds of beans. I don't like beans at all.
Oh, those Mormons know how to have fun, don't they? That's Brother Thompson and the Bean Sisters from YouTube, the Food Storage Blues. I just have to get these buckets and bags into the basement before the mother-in-law comes. Radio EcoShock, where the dark future fun never stops. Check out our website at ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. As always, thank you for joining in this week. Let's kick the system next week while we still can.
I feel like I'm clear cut. Like my rivers have run dry, and I'm raw beneath the open sky.
arms will carry me home.